You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
On Cambridge 105, with Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant, and we've got a busy show for you today. Our studio guest today is Hina Bilic. She's talking about her debut novel, Set Me Free. We'll also hear from Joanne Lindberg, author of Small Pieces, a book of lamentations. Diana Gerald and Nadia Shireen tell me about the Time to Read campaign launched by the Book Trust. And if that's not enough, Kate Fleet from Heffers gives us detail of forthcoming events at the bookshop. But first of all, welcome to Hina Bilic, our studio guest today. Welcome, Hina.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here.
Oh, well, lovely to have you here. We're going to give you a proper introduction in just a moment, but we're learning about the Time to Read campaign later on in the show. Now, you're a busy lady, but you do have two young children, 9 and 11 years old, is that
right? That's right, yes.
Do you find time to read with them?
I do. It's not always easy, but we read in the evenings, and the only problem I find is that the children never want it to stop. So trying to close it down and say it's time to sleep is the difficulty.
And do you remember being read to yourself?
In fact, I wasn't actually read to as a child, but what did happen is that my mum and dad used to tell me lots and lots of stories from their youth, from their when they grew up, crazy ideas about my grandmother and a djinn being in love with her, and stories about my father and his father and how he was a horseback policeman. And so there were fabulous, amazing, enriching stories always being told.
No wonder you became a writer with all that whizzing around your head.
It's so true.
So much to draw on, isn't there? Well, as I say, we're going to give you a proper introduction in just a moment, but we'll listen to your first choice of music now, which is Everything I Own by Bread. Why this one?
Well, I mean, a couple of reasons, really. Obviously, the themes within it are quite related to Set Me Free, my novel, but I did lose my parents last year in quite tragic circumstances, and this song just makes me dissolve in tears. And I was interested to know that the lead singer of Bread actually wrote this song for after he lost his father.
You gave my life to me, set me free, set me free. The finest years I ever knew. Ahead with you.
That's Everything I Own by Bread, the first choice of music from our studio guest today on Bookmark, Hina Bilic. Hina's first novel, Set Me Free, was an Amazon best debut, a Love Reading Book of the Year and a Marie Claire Book of the Month. It tells the story of Mani, forced to flee Pakistan with her mother and her brother Nu. But in the UK, when the past catches up with her, Mani looks for salvation in an arranged marriage, only to find that her situation becomes far worse. While the novel deals with issues such as domestic violence, honour killings and immigration, Herald Scotland, who chose it as a book of the week, describe it as a story not of surrender, but of resilience, of hope overcoming adversity. And Hina, I'm guessing that's a description you very much agree with.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think the thing that I think is really central to the novel and to Mani is that she's after love, and love is the centre or the one thing she seeks above all else. And it's really her journey to finding that love that she feels is so missing in her life that the book describes. That's the journey that the book takes you on.
But, and it's a difficult subject that you're addressing, not just the issue of domestic abuse, but a woman who chooses to stay in a violent relationship.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. And that's the thing. I mean, I always find as an author that certain things sort of snag on your synapses. They stay in your mind and you can't easily lose them. And the thing I found about the whole scenario of love is the notion of crazy love, insane love, mad love. What is love? What is it really? And in situations like that, where you have such a close relationship between people, why is it that some of the ugliest things can arise? And then if that does happen, when people are subjected to domestic violence or abuse, why do they not walk away? And that was the question that always crossed my mind, that made me, you know, wonder. And that's what I explored in Set Me Free. And also, it doesn't, from the research that I did, it doesn't relate to how educated you are. It doesn't relate to even whether or not you are in an oppressive situation. Very often, Western women, educated women, will be in relationships where they find they're subjected to violence, but they have somehow or other explained it away and essentially believe that they are trying to remedy a problem in the other person, and they're just helping them. And so it's a complete, if you like, it turns the reality of love upside down on its head. As I've said, that if someone came up to you in the streets and did that, you would be onto the police straight away. And yet, in a loving relationship in a household, people in those scenarios will tolerate it.
You had to create a background and a character that would have stayed in that situation, because we know why she's staying there, what she believes she's doing there. So where did you start with that?
Well, exactly. And this is, in terms of being an author, that's a very important aspect of the whole thing. So there has to be, in my view, something that, some sort of damage, some sort of flaw in the person. And it's very aligned to real life, because we all have difficult scenarios. We've all been brought up with things that were perhaps difficult to face. And so for Mani, it was a sense of guilt, because she had not acted. She'd witnessed a murder, but she wasn't quite sure who was being affected. But it was an honour killing, a family killing. But she chose to protect herself. She chose to hide. And that then lived with her for the rest of her time. And she could, and that was why she was almost, it was a sense of not being worthy. So whenever anything bad did happen in her life, or particularly when it did with Khan, she was of the view that really it was all that she deserved, because she really should have done better in her life. And so that was the, if you like, the premise on which I sort of built the domestic violence scenario. And in some ways, when you think about novels like Gone Girl, it's a similar sort of thing. There's a reason why people stay in a relationship that's always, it's hard to define, but it can unravel through the telling of the tale.
It's hard, I think, when you're writing about that scenario, because this your character comes from Pakistan as well.
Yes.
That you don't want to give in to stereotypes and confirm people's stereotypes. And obviously you must have been aware of that.
I was very aware of that. And that's why the most important element of the story is altogether different. It's the affair that she is having.
We don't want to give too much away, do we? Let's not give too much away. But yes, it becomes apparent that she's writing letters to somebody.
That's right,
at
exactly.
The beginning of the book, and we don't find out who to until the end. We won't give away that ending.
Okay, fair enough.
Nevertheless, you're dealing with images or possible stereotypes of a Pakistani marriage and family and heritage and pressures.
That's right. And a lot of that came because, I mean, although my upbringing was entirely Western, I did actually, ironically, after having a failed love marriage, end up in an arranged marriage and agreeing to an arranged marriage, which was astonishing and shocking to me as much as anyone else. And as a result, I learnt through my husband about quite a lot of issues that arise and things that happen. And yes, it is the edge of society. It's not the central. There's a lot of fabulous things that happen. But it's interesting. It's interesting that this sort of thing still exists, that there still is the ability for women to be so terribly oppressed and yet be the vehicle of oppression themselves. They are, in some ways, not given a way out. They don't understand the way out, which I find interesting. And that in the back of my mind, what I was thinking. I wanted to provide a way out. I wanted to show the redemptive power of love. Sounds very corny, but it's true.
Well, and we will talk to you about your arranged marriage, because you yourself have written about it, and it's a very happy arranged marriage.
It is indeed.
Your husband is waiting outside the studio as we speak. But we'll take it. Well, it is a diversion, and it's not. It's about a woman's relationship to her past and her faith. Joanne Lemberg has written three poetry collections. Her first, Feminismo, was shortlisted for the Forward Best First Collection Prize, and Paraphernalia, published in 2007, was a Poetry Society recommended book. Her novel about Queen Anne, A Want of Kindness, received rave reviews, but her most recent book, a memoir, Small Pieces, A Book of Lamentations, explores the aftermath of her younger brother's suicide and Joanne's relationship to her family and Judaism. I asked Joanne when I met her if the book that has emerged is the one she set out to write.
In a way, yes, though it took me a very circuitous route to get there. I always wanted something that would, in its form, represent the sort of fragmentary experience of a trauma and a loss, but also that would bring it together somehow. So the structure of it, the different chapters, they're called vessels, I'll explain why in a minute, full of fragments, was something I was thinking about. It started off as a PhD, and I started out with a lot of different fragmentary bits, and I thought, oh, I'm going to finish this incredibly quickly. Then my supervisor pointed out there wasn't really a rationale to them. So a lot of time was spent trying to come up with a way to pull it all together. And my Jewish background is very important in the book. I went back to a creation story from the Kabbalah called The Breaking of the Vessels. And the idea is that before this universe, there was a perfect one made of sort of 10 emanations of light or spirit or whatever. And they were all held in vessels, and the vessels couldn't contain them. The vessels broke. So what we're living in is the smashed remnants of a broken universe. And the idea is that our work as Jews, but as human beings, really, is to just reassemble these vessels. So I had the idea of myself picking up the fragments of my family narrative and just putting them into vessels, and that the arrangement would be provisional, but that it would be an arrangement, and it would be a start, and the book would be dramatising of me trying to pull these things together.
And it works. And you start each chapter, each vessel, mm-hmm. if you like, with a little bit of scripture.
Yes.
Was that always the intention?
No, that came in later. I met a rabbi when I was mourning for my brother and thinking about writing about him. And we were talking about this, the idea of the Kabbalah and the breaking of the vessels and the repair of the world. The word is tikkun olam in Hebrew. He said, have you heard of Pirkei Avot, the sayings of the fathers? And I hadn't. And he said, there's one that goes, it is not for us to complete the work, but neither may we desist from it. I mean, there are various translations, but that's one version of it. And I thought, oh, that's a lovely structuring principle for the book. So I then put the rabbi at the beginning, and I realised that there's a lot of questions and answers in Judaism. And rabbis, as I explained, they're not priests, but they're supposedly they know more than you about scripture, and they're there to answer questions. So I thought I will start each chapter with a question to an imaginary rabbi.
And it seems to me that the book is as much about you exploring that very traumatic period in your past as about exploring not your faith, but your relationship to faith.
Yes, well, I realised that they were inextricably connected, as I explain in the book, because Judaism is such a family-based religion. I can't think about it without thinking about my community, without thinking about my extended family, without thinking about my mother. So the complicated feelings that my brother and I had towards my mother and our family and our relationship to it and what was expected from us, from the family, was entirely bound up with that. And I realised there was no point trying to disentangle them, so I would go the other way.
And you always said this was a period of your life that you wouldn't write about.
Yes.
Why did you change your mind?
Well, I think always on some level I knew I would, because as you'll know from my other personal stuff, it's how I sort things out. Alongside the creative part of my PhD, I was reading a lot of trauma theory, and I recognised my own conflicting impulses in that literature. There's a trauma theorist called Shoshana Fellman who talks about an appointment to bear witness. And she said if you witness something traumatic or go through a traumatic experience, then it's kind of seizes you by the scruff, and you have this appointment to bear witness that's like a court subpoena, so you can't delegate it, you can't indefinitely defer it, you can't refuse it. And so I knew that in the end I would be compelled by the pressure of this experience to witness what had happened.
And you have a history of writing books that are very personal. In the biography you wrote of Queen Anne was very personal.
It was.
You reflected back on your own experiences. What boundaries do you set when you're writing something like that? Or is everything that is you on the page?
There are some things that I hold back. But I'd set up such a high standard for truth in this book that I put things in I was really quite uncomfortable putting in, but I knew that they had to go in or I wasn't fulfilling the contract that I'd set myself up for. So I did make myself very uncomfortable. There are certain things I do. I'm careful with other people's information. Also, I changed almost everyone's name. I never mentioned my son's name. I didn't give him a fake name because I knew that I would never manage to remember it and stick to it in reading. So he's just my son, my son, my son, all the way through.
And it's very challenging for a reader to hear so much. So it's quite raw, a lot of what you put on the page. You're aware of the reader's response, presumably.
I am. And a review I've seen so far on the Jewish Chronicle said they felt quite intrusive in a way. But even though you can assume that if I put it on the page, I'm okay with it. I'm aware that I'm making the reader uncomfortable, but I know that I'm okay with books making me uncomfortable, so I'm not putting them anywhere I wouldn't go myself.
And is there something about playing with the form of memoir slightly that it's not just saying this is me, but this is me in your life, this is me making you feel uncomfortable?
Maybe. Since I wrote The Woman Who Thought Too Much, that was my book about OCD, I've had lots of messages back, and I've come to realise how much, when you're writing memoir, and specifically, and you're putting it out there, you're initiating a conversation or continuing a conversation. So this book is, in a way, continuing an argument with my family, but it's also initiating a conversation with people out there. So there's a lot of blank space in the book, and partly I think that that's to give the reader room to respond.
And you're always very clear that this is your version.
Absolutely.
What has been your family's reaction to the book?
Well, I was very worried about my sister-in-law reading it, but it was wonderful when I showed her because she just had the best possible reaction. She said, "I see how it was for you now," and she hugged me. So the book was a means of bringing us closer and reconciliation, which was wonderful. All the family members who've read it have been really lovely about it.
And of course, the line that's often trotted out with books like this is that it's very cathartic to, and it was very healing. Was it?
Well, I sort of chose a form that would resist any kind of closure, because I know that there isn't closure. So if you mean cathartic in the sense of, oh, well, that's all sorted out now. No, it isn't. But it definitely gives you something. It enables you to stay in touch with these lost people because you're, again, talking with them in the book. And you know that they won't be forgotten because it's out there. So it does something.
Did it help you understand your brother better?
I still felt he was a bit of a mystery at the end. It helped me understand my mother better.
Your brother feels a bit of a mystery to the reader as well.
Yes, well, I thought that was important. I think there's a certain kind of memoir I didn't want to write, where the surviving sibling goes back and they do a kind of detective story on the dead person and go, so this was why they... And I thought, no, actually, I respect his privacy too much to do that. And also, he didn't know why he did it. He said specifically in his note that he didn't know why he did it. So if he didn't know, it's no business of mine to.
Is this a book that you might add to in the future as either your feelings change about this or you learn a little more?
It is possible, yes. I mean, at the moment I'm writing different things, but I don't think I'll ever be done with this.
And what is next for you?
Well, I'm working on a book called, at the moment it's called Letters to My Weird Sisters. It's an incredibly early stage. And it's thinking about my own Asperger's diagnosis, which I don't talk about in small pieces because it's not part of that story. And I'm thinking about women in the past who might have had a diagnosis had they lived now. So I'm writing letters to them because I think I said earlier about the book being part of a conversation. I've become very interested in this and the idea of writing back. And I like the idea that I would leave space in the book for the reader then to write back to me.
With this upcoming book and with your previous work, as we've said, you mine a lot of it from yourself. How does that feel in terms of using yourself as subject matter?
it feels like something I'm compelled to do because I'm compelled to work things out. But at the same time, I do feel a sense of shame about it. And I wish I didn't. I'm aware that the kind of writing I do is kind of looked a bit askance. And I'm aware of blabbing. The phrase that keeps coming into my head about this book is all washing our dirty linen in public, which is a very telling phrase. It's a very physical phrase, isn't it? But I think I also believe that it's an important thing to do. Somebody's got to tell the truth somewhere and open up that space for other people to say these things they haven't felt able to say.
Oh, it's very sad that you feel shame about it, because if you were an artist putting it on a canvas, somehow people would just accept that as natural.
There's something about the fact that everyone can write to a certain degree that makes it feel as if there's no art to it, and also that it's just a naughty thing to be doing.
And you are going off now to teach, to be a creative writing teacher in this specific area of memoir, life writing?
No, I'm going to be teaching across genres, because at De Montfort, where I'm going to teach, they have this lovely approach where they teach thematically. So all the students have to try out all the genres. And it's not till they get to the third year that they decide what to do.
And this is almost like a next step in your journey as a writer as well.
It is, yes. And again, it's like I'm saying, it's about opening it up to other people. Interacting with other people, talking to them about their writing, just opening things out.
And Small Pieces, a Book of Lamentations by Joanne Lindberg, is published by Atlantic Books. You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105. My studio guest is Hina Belitz, author of the debut novel Set Me Free. And Hina, you were listening to Joanne there with me. They're a different situation, but echoes of the writing situation is quite similar, I think.
I think that the idea of addressing difficult things in life, difficult things that people face, is definitely a parallel there. Although, obviously, Set Me Free is very much fiction, and it's very much, if you like, a journey of a particular protagonist from one particular place to another that hopefully does provide the arc.
But in your book, there's an arranged marriage, and we were talking earlier on about your own arranged marriage.
Yes.
How much of, I mean, clearly the two endings are very different.
Very different.
One is very happy and one is not. But how much did you put in of your experience into the book?
Yes, well I did put quite a lot in. And what I've been really fascinated with over a considerable amount of time is cultural crossovers and the power that we can gain from truly understanding other cultures. And I always regard myself to be in one of those very privileged positions of having a vantage point, a clear vantage point of two different cultures, that of my ancestry, my parents, and that that I grew up in here. And I think that there is a knee-jerk reaction, and that's what I love about this, is that there's a knee-jerk reaction against anything that is other. And I think what I really love is the idea of bringing the power and the beauty of the other. And I think that was really what came out of some other projects I was invited to take part in, which I'm sure we'll go on to.
Oh, well, no, let's talk about that. You're talking about Morgan Freeman.
I'm talking about Morgan Freeman.
We can't put Morgan Freeman on hold. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I had this email and a call from the US, and I literally nearly hung up the phone thinking, get out of here, because I was told that it was the National Geographic and who wanted to possibly talk to me about the writing that they had seen in Guardian Family and Set Me Free. And they wanted to talk to me about, in particular, the arranged marriage I had, which followed a love marriage that was a disaster, and how the arranged marriage ended up being beautiful and wonderful. And so after I decided not to hang up the phone...
Good move.
And decide that there may well be something genuine here. There may be someone genuinely speaking at the other end of the phone. I actually had a series of like interviews over the telephone with a team of people. I didn't know who they were, but they were talking to me about a very wide range of cultural issues and things I understood and felt. And of course, this is my hobby horse. This is what I love. I mean, you know, the idea of the stories about the heroism and how the only man that saved a chap that had fallen onto a track at rush hour train times was a black man, and how maybe heroism is born out of standing out from the crowd, having to stand out of the crowd, those sorts of things. So I was talking just about all the things that interest and fascinate me. And then they said they'd very much like to interview me for the actual show, which is called The Story of Us, and follows a very successful series they had called The Story of God. And so they go, there are six episodes, and they go all around the world talking to people with interesting stories to tell, and I was one of them. So
it was about sort of overcoming the knee-jerk reaction or addressing the knee-jerk reaction that you say that
it really
people
was.
Have to the words arranged marriage.
It was, and I think it's I mean, just looking at the number of shares and comments that the Guardian Family article had, it sort of shows how much of a hot topic it is. And I think a lot of confusion comes out of the fact that people mistake the word arranged to forced, and it's very different from a forced marriage, and it is actually quite prevalent, the whole arranged marriage scene, but I think the difference is that being a person that doesn't come from an environment, culture, background that had to have that, and then choosing it was the point. And I think this really opens up some of the mysteries of love, some of the things I think as a culture we've got very wrong about love. I think there's a lot of loneliness out there, a lot of people that never quite find what they're looking for, and I think a lot of that could be so beautifully remedied if they opened up their minds to understand the way that other cultures deal with things. And the beauty of The Story of Us, but with Morgan Freeman, is that is what they do. They look at different people all over the world dealing with different issues in different cultural scenarios, and actually opening up to the other, opening up to the differences. There's a fabulous quote that Karen Armstrong made in her TED Prize-winning speech, and it's a quote from the Quran, which I think is really relevant here, and it talks about how the Creator made us into different tribes and nations so that we may come to know each other. And I think that was central at the back of my mind always, and part of the driver behind Set Me Free was very much about bringing into the experience of the Western mindset some of the beauties and some of the differences of a different culture. That's why I even used some of the language, because there are words, I love words, and there are some words that you can never truly translate. I mean, like the word ronak, which is an Urdu word for activity and family and bubbling pots of food, and there isn't an equivalent. And so it's all that sort of thing, understanding that there is so much to be gained by truly understanding the other. And me sitting on that bridge between the two.
Well, and getting to meet Morgan Freeman.
Who was fabulous, by the way.
Of course. We'll hear your second piece of music, Nana. This is the script, The Man Who Can't Be Moved. Why this one?
Oh, I had such a perfect image of Manny, the main character, standing on a street waiting and hoping that her lover on the London buses would just by chance step off and meet her there. And then I heard this song and I thought, this is perfect.
Got some words on cardboard, got your picture in my hand, saying, if you see this girl, can you tell her where I am? Some try to hand me money, but they don't understand. I'm not broke, I'm just a broken-hearted man. I know it makes no sense, but what else can I do? And how can I move on when I'm still in love with you? 'Cause if one day
Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations rather than boasts.
Yes, you're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers. And as you've heard, Bookmark is sponsored and very proudly by Heffer's Bookshop, very proudly on our behalf anyway. And recently I met Kate Fleet, events manager at Heffer's, to have a chat with her about what's coming up at the bookshop in the next month or so. Kate, just tell me about a few of the events coming up at Heffer's.
Well, there's a lot, I'm pleased to say. On the 17th of October, which is a Tuesday at 6:30, we've got Patrick Barkham, who's a nature writer for The Guardian, with his new book Islander, which is about his journey around our archipelago. So looking forward to that one.
That looks really interesting. It looks a beautiful book.
Yes, gold and green, the cover, I think, is going to be when it arrives. So Yeah, he's going to be talking about his journey around the smallest islands of Britain and all the things that he discovered while he was doing that, including a rare subspecies of vole, nuns and puffins.
What's not to like about that evening? Voles, nuns and puffins.
Yes. And then on the 26th of October, this event is actually being hosted at the Wesley Methodist Church, not at Heffer's, but it is our event. It's with Dan Jones, who I'm sure many people will know from his history programmes on the television. And he's going to be talking about the Templars, the rise and fall of God's holy warriors.
The Templars are very sort of in or trendy, aren't they? Because Dan Brown made them famous in the Da Vinci Code.
Yes, so I'm assuming this is a sort of slightly more serious and factual account of their rise and fall. So yes, very pleased to have Dan coming along.
Yes, he's quite a figure, isn't he?
Mm.
And for people interested in classics, you've got a big event coming up at the end of October.
Yes, we do. On Saturday the 28th, it's our Classics Forum, which is in its fifth year. It's a full-day event, and we've got 13 authors from the world of classics, including Paul Cartledge, who some people may know locally, and Ian Ross, Michael Scott will be taking part in the event as well.
And it's Natalie Haynes, I see.
Yes, she's on the list as well.
Yeah. Radio and as a comedian.
Yep. So, I mean, as I said, it's in its fifth year and people do really seem to enjoy it. So we're looking forward to hosting it again. And that one is taking place in the library at the Cambridge Union Society.
And do you need to know a lot about the classics to enjoy that, do you think?
I attended my first festival of it last year and I have to admit I know nothing about classics and I still really enjoyed the day. Yeah, it's not pitched at a really high academic level, but neither of it, it's not fluff either.
A healthy interest.
General appeal, yes. And then the last event in October, taking place on Halloween, is our Deadly Women event with Sophie Hanna, Alison Bruce and Emily Winslow, all three of whom are local crime writers. And I'm sure many of your listeners will be familiar with them. This event is a discussion on women and how they are represented in the crime genre and whether they are, in fact, deadlier than men. And the event is to coincide with the release of a new anthology of crime fiction by female writers. Of course, the ladies involved have all contributed stories. And so they will be having a discussion and then invite attendees to proffer their opinion on the
That's
subject.
That's a brilliant event because all three of those writers, really high calibre writers.
Yes, we're delighted to be hosting them.
And on Halloween, of course.
Yes, what could be better? Then going on to November, on the 1st, we are hosting Nicola Upson's launch, her new book Nine Lessons, which is set in Cambridge and in Suffolk. And Nicola's going to be in conversation with Alison Graham, who writes for the Radio Times. That should be a really interesting discussion. And we love Nicola's books.
We love Nicola because she's a co-presenter at Cambridge 105. Yes. And her books, are great.
Yes, that should be a really enjoyable evening. And then going on to the 9th of November, this is quite close to my heart, this one. It's an evening of ghost stories. We're calling it The Spirit of Winter, and it's three authors, Laura Purcell, Neil Spring and Elodie Harper, who will all be coming along to read from their books and sending a chill up our spines. Another one to look forward to. That is in the bookshop, sort of in keeping with the style of M.R. James. We're going to be offering all of our guests a glass of sherry.
Excellent. It's going to be candlelit.
Well, possibly electric candles due to the amount of paper in the shop.
Oh, yes,
but yes, yes, it will be atmospheric and, good fun.
So if people are interested in any of these events, what do they do?
Well, there's various ways to get in touch. You can pop into the shop and ask about the events and book a ticket if you fancy coming along. You could give us a ring on 01223 463 200, or you can go online to our Eventbrite page, which is heffersbookshop.eventbrite.com.
And that website address, heffersbookshop.eventbrite.com. That was Kate Fleet from Heffers. My studio guest on Bookmark today is Hina Bilitz. Hina, what's the story of your book? How did that become from something that you were writing to... it's published by Headline, isn't it? Journey there?
Well, I mean, I've always been passionate about books and writing, but as a busy lawyer and a mum, I never thought I would actually... do anything. I dreamt about it, absolutely dreamt about writing novels. But I went along to a course, a Faber Academy course, a couple of others as well, and I came across a particular tutor who was very inspirational for me. And she was so in awe of the work that I'd written.
Who was that? Let's give her a name check.
Yeah, yeah, it's Shelley Weiner. And she was so in awe of the work that I'd done, and she literally almost embarrassed me. Well, she did embarrass me in class. And I think from that moment I started to get more confidence about maybe the style and the feel and the flow, the rhythm of my writing had something. And but I didn't really think much of it, but... At the end of certain courses, there's often an anthology produced. And as a result of that, I was approached by five agents. And I'd never actually... So, you know, the reality is I've never actually sent a piece of work out. But these agents were phenomenal and amazing and so encouraging and very keen to get me signed up. And so from that, I chose John Ellick of United Agents.
And how did the book evolve during the writing? Because it's told from one point of view,
yes,
all along, from Manny's point of view. And as I was reading, I wondered if that had always been the case, or were there different points of view?
It was always told from her point of view. I think the love letters helped because it created a different perspective, because one first person point of view can be quite claustrophobic if you're not careful. And so, but yes, it was always told from that point of view, although my current book, which is out next year, is told from... the third person point of view. But yes, I think in the end, it's a very interesting process to try and decide what works. But I think so often you just have to do it and see how you feel. And if it's not feeling right, then try something else and then decide which point of view or which perspective you want to write from.
And quite a challenging book to write as your debut novel. There are some difficult scenes in there,
yes,
the domestic violence scenes.
Yes.
How was it writing those?
Well, I mean, it was difficult. And I remember even as I reviewed and edited, some of the scenes, you know, created a visceral reaction in me. And I had intended that. I didn't know where, often when you write, you don't know where these things come from. And I remember being very surprised myself that the character that I was thinking of, that the particular scene required a certain action to take place, because, you know, domestic violence is a very ugly thing, and it's a very curious thing, as we know from The Archers and the big domestic violence furor around all of that. And I think that unless you show it with a certain degree of honesty, it's not going to ring true. And so, and the really crazy part is it's not so much the physical violence, it's the emotional trauma that results from the violence and the words. And I think that's what I tried to get across as well. But in order to truly have a redemptive, a sort of the escape element, you needed to build that up. You needed for people to truly be there, and you can't be there by sugarcoating something like that.
And the idea of love and romance is very important to you. I mean, I've
yes,
heard that in your talking just throughout this programme. It was something that you very much wanted to say in the novel.
Exactly. I think that there is this notion that the only real kind of love is crazy love, insane love, mad love. And it's strange because you don't ever think of love as truly... I mean, it's not practical, it's not logical. The whole point of love, I think that the most powerful, I mean, it's in many ways, it's like Romeo and Juliet, and a very famous story that I remember being told by my parents was the story of Leila and Majnun, which is very much like the Romeo and Juliet. In fact, word has it that it may have been the source of Romeo and Juliet. And it's these ancient love stories, telling stories of unrequited love and the power of that love and the insanity that love induces. And I was really looking to try and create that degree of intensity. And I think that that can only come generally when people have suffered a certain amount of adversity. Ultimately, it is the case, one of the quotes in the book is that, you know, the vessel from, it's the Khalil Gibran quote about the vessel that from which we carve, that we fill with happiness is carved out of our, you know, our the adversity that we suffer. And so it was really about that. And I think that the overriding thing that came to mind, as even as I wrote, is that I think that the most powerful, the most beautiful, the most memorable and everlasting love stories tend to be about love that is so extreme, that is so desperate. And I was trying to make sure that that came across.
Oh, I think that does come across very much. Thank you. Well, we talked earlier on about the Book Trust's campaign. They recently launched the Time to Read campaign aimed at parents of young children. It followed on from research commissioned to explore how often parents or carers spend time reading with their children. I spoke down the line to the Book Trust chief executive, Diana Gerald, and children's writer and illustrator, Nadia Shireen. And I started by asking Diana what the research had shown.
We've been talking to parents about how often they do story time and what's standing in their way of reading to their kids, and quite a lot coming back about how do you balance that against the amount of time on screen, and also parents confessing to missing out the pages or skipping paragraphs just to get the story to an end before bedtime.
And this is because parents have a heavy workload or are giving in to online distractions, presumably.
Lots and lots of things going on. It's partly screen time, but it's also parents saying, well, look, I'm juggling a job, or two of us are working and we don't have much time, or the household chores still needing to be done, or I've got two or three children and they all want to do different things along the way. So our response to that is, how can we make life easier for parents? How can we encourage parents to do that thing of finding 10 minutes a day to read to your child? And that's why we're launching the National Time to Read Challenge, asking parents to have a think about carving out 10 minutes a day to read with their kid, not making this a big deal or yet another thing to add to your list, but working out how you can have some fun with your kid.
And what are the benefits of reading with children?
It's almost the magic cure-all. If you start reading with your child young, it's great for their language development. It helps them to be school ready. And over the longer term, children who read regularly and love reading do better at school and in later life. It also helps build empathy. When we read, we have an open door into other worlds, to the way other people think and for people to different backgrounds to ourselves. And also, of course, you can hoover up lots of facts with any non-fiction book.
But there is a skill to reading with a child, isn't there?
Actually, I'm not too sure there is. I think when we say skill, it makes it sound very difficult. It's a bit like when we talk about running around with a kid. Is there a particular way of running? Actually, you open the book, you read to the kid, you see what they like, you see what you like. I mean, the very best readers, and Nadia will comment on this, can read amazingly, but there's lots of us who are not so great at reading, and your child will still love it because it's time with you, focused time, interactive time.
And Nadia, there are things in stories written for children that are there for the adults too, aren't there? So it's not necessarily just a story for a toddler about, say, a duck that learns to swim. There's often something on the pages for the grown-up too, isn't there?
Yeah, look, I mean, a story is a story, and there are so many picture books out there that are beautifully illustrated. And yeah, that there's loads for parents to enjoy. You can be any age and enjoy a picture book. When I'm drawing and writing my picture books, I'm looking to make myself laugh and, you know, engage myself as much as a kid. There's not really an age limit on, you know, drawing a bear in a bee suit is funny whatever age you are, I think.
And would you recommend when reading to children that you point things out, develop accents for the different characters, that kind of thing? How would you suggest making it more interesting for both of you?
However you like to do it. I mean, you know, you might like to do an amazing Sean Connery impression for some characters. Definitely take your time on each page. If you know, follow your child's lead. If your child is suddenly obsessed with a little picture of a bee in the corner, then chat about it. That's the great thing about books. They are as interactive as any app.
And I suppose it's creating memories, isn't it? Not just of the book, but of the moment, that downtime, that moment with a parent.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I think that they're not going to remember if you forgot to do the, you know, the hoovering that day. They are going to remember that you snuggled up under a blanket and read a funny book together.
And what books do you remember?
I used to love the Megan Mogg books. I don't know if you remember those. You know, slightly older, I was obsessed with Roald Dahl, loved Winnie the Pooh, Richard Starry. He did some great books. Harry the Dirty Dog, that was another favourite.
I'm seconding Winnie the Pooh, who I loved, and somehow the attitude of that little bear is still with me. I love the Narnia books, didn't get any of the mythology, but love the idea of going camping and being a brave king and queen, and suddenly you were special. And a bit embarrassing to admit, I was obsessed as a kid with the Jill's Ponies series. I didn't have a pony, I didn't even hardly knew what a horse looked like, and I certainly wasn't going to be riding because it was way too expensive. But I happily immersed myself in this completely different world of this girl who looked after five ponies, and it was just a different place for me to be.
And if parents are feeling a little nervous about reading with their children, if they don't know quite what to do, is there help available?
You can go to our website, booktrust.org.uk, which has lots and tips and tricks for reading. But what I would also say to parents is, it's not a test. There isn't a right way to do it. It's a way of having fun. No child is going to turn around to you and say, you didn't do that sentence completely and utterly right. Or if they are, at least you can congratulate yourself that they're a very smart cookie. What they really want is the time to be with you and to have fun. And the biggest tip I always give to any parent is, choose a book that you love too. Because if you love it, then you'll want to spend the time reading with that, with your child as well.
Late at night, parents are often tired or thinking about what they need to do at work the next day. If that is the case, what would you suggest they do? Read earlier in the evening?
I think there's quite a lot about finding the time which is right for you. So we know that if you read just before bedtime, it can help your child sleep. But if it's not right for you and your family, I've been thinking quite a lot about this. For some families, actually, I found that reading over breakfast works brilliantly. Everybody's wide awake. You've got a captive audience over the cornflakes. Or maybe, as you say, you read when you come in from school. So it's finding a time which works for you and your family and your child. And every family and every child is different. And you'll know best when's the time to sneak in that 10 minutes of reading.
Diana, you're Chief Executive of the Book Trust. Can you tell me a little bit about their work?
We're all about getting children reading and helping mums and dads and carers to read with their kids. We have the Time to Read programme. We're also behind Bookstart, which gets books and advice to the parent of every new baby in the country every year. And our aim is really to help children and parents find the book that they love and find ways of reading which work for them.
And finally, Nadia, when you're writing a book, you're not just thinking of your child reader, but the adult reader too, presumably, because you know the books are going to be read aloud to children by adults.
You've got to think of everyone. So I think about my child reader first. I'd say I really want to make them laugh and I really want to keep their attention over 32 pages. But yeah, I'm also thinking about parents, teachers, librarians. You've got a broad audience with a picture book, but hopefully I kind of managed to balance all the elements to keep everyone interested.
That was Nadia Shireen there talking with Diana Gerald from the Book Trust. That website address again, booktrust.org.uk. And Nadia's book, well, she's written lots of books. She's written and illustrated a lot of children's books. But the one she was talking about there, about the bear in a bee suit, The Bumble Bear, that one is published by Jonathan Cape. Well, we're coming, sadly, to the end of our time with you, Hina Billitz, here on Bookmark. But we were talking about parents there, and the book is dedicated to your mother, who sadly didn't live to see it published, is that right?
That's right, yes. It was a very strange time for me because I lost both my parents at the time that was probably going to be the happiest time ever because it was a publication of my debut novel. And I do remember going into the intensive care unit and trying to show my mother the actual book cover. It was very, very sad and it was very, very such a mixed time. I know she'd have been so proud and so happy. She was the proudest ever that I had the book deal, but she hadn't actually managed to see the book in its final form or published. And my father, I mean, he would have been over the moon. So
well, it's a lovely dedication you make to her on the front. And what next for you now then? You mentioned the second
yes,
novel.
That's right. Yes, I have a next novel coming out in June, and it's Addie Mayford, Will Survive, or we've got a couple of other possible titles, but it's a very different book, and it's centred around the mystery and the power again of cultural differences, this time more in the nature of food.
Oh, so, excellent.
Yes.
And the question that we ask all our guests on Bookmark, what are you reading at the moment?
Yes, well, I've just read Eleanor Oliphant Is Completely Fine and thoroughly enjoyed it. Very, very good book. Completely mad at times, but wonderful.
Have you got another one lined up?
Yes, I have so many books. It's absolutely insane how many books I've got lined up to read. But I do also enjoy reading slightly sort of non-fiction books and books that you wouldn't ordinarily consider. But yes, I've got so many that I've got lined up to read. But the ones that I suppose there's a really crazy book about called Of Dishes and Discourse, which is to do with the power and the cultural importance of foods in different cultures. And so I'm looking at that one to read next.
I think once you've had a book published as well, you get more books, don't you? Because people want your comments on the books that are out there. They want your name on
the
sleeve.
That's very true. Exactly right.
Oh, well, enjoy.
Thank you.
Well, we've been talking today with Hina Bilitz about her novel Set Me Free, which is published by Headline. Hina, we're going to come back to you in just a moment to hear your final choice of music. But in our next show, our next bookmark, we'll be speaking to novelist Judith Lennox. We'll also hear from children's writer Victor Watson and storyteller Chip Colquhoun. In the meantime, please check out our Facebook page, follow us and like us there. And on that page, there's a chance to win a signed copy of Hina's book. You can also go to the website, cambridge105.co.uk, and hear all the previous episodes of Bookmark. They're all up there, along with the many other fabulous shows that this station broadcasts. But we're going to sign out now with your last choice of music, Hina, which is Wedding Plans by Howard Shore from the film Twilight. Why this one?
This is really about, the power of love and the power of family relationships. In many ways, it sort of brought to mind the beauty of marriage and the beauty of weddings. That was what was in the back of my mind at the time. But it's just such a moving and beautiful piece of music.